Welcome in to the 48 Minutes podcast on Believe, presented by Bet Online. I'm Ross Geiger, the former NBA video coordinator, having spent time with the Bucks, Suns, and Knicks. And I'm joined alongside the two-time Emmy Award winner, Michael World B. Freer, who is a senior stat writer at Stat Factor, specializing in writing advanced statistical NBA reports for various announcers across the league. This is episode number 102. The Shai Gilgeous-Alexander episode, as SGA has worn number two throughout his entire career and also finished number two in this year's MVP voting. Before we get into tonight's show, just a quick reminder, BetOnline is your number one source for all your summer sports this season, from MLB, golf, NBA, and NHL playoff stats. All the latest stats, news, and scores available to follow your favorite teams. Get the latest odds and lines, including the latest team matchups, player props, and odds on just about every sport out there. Head to the website today or use your mobile device to get in on the action. Bet online, where the game starts. And to start off our first half here, World B, let's jump right into our Game 4 reactions of the Celtics-Cavs series. The Celtics went ahead 3-1, winning this one 109-102 on the road in Cleveland. However, I do want to point out, despite the fact that Donovan Mitchell and Jared Allen were both out due to injury for the Cavs, this is the closest deficit for Boston in a victory during this year's playoffs. So a lot of heart, a lot of grit from Cleveland. Obviously fell a little bit short. I've got some reasons why I think they did fall short here tonight, but curious to get your initial thoughts.
Yeah, it was a really good effort by Cleveland, as shorthanded as they were, to make this close. The defense really came to play, especially after the first quarter. They really basically shut down Boston's offense, which, you know, as we talked about, it's the most efficient offense in the history of the league. And they only score 109 points on Monday. That's pretty impressive. But Boston also has one of the league's best defense, so they were able to shut down Cleveland without two starters, including their best player in Donovan Mitchell. My first thought was the criticism had started to come down on Jason Tatum in the last few days. When's he going to have that breakout game? Oh, he's not as good as everybody says. All this stuff. And now he gets back-to-back games at 30-plus points. He's still not shooting the ball all that great. He didn't have a great shooting night on Monday in Game 4. But he's getting to the line, which is a big deal. He's doing all the other things. He's grabbing rebounds like crazy in this postseason. He's dishing the ball out with assists. He's playing good defense, had two steals on Monday. So he's doing what, you know, back-to-back 30-point games – hopefully quiets the naysayers a little bit. And I talked to you before we went on. What is Cleveland, one of the worst shooting teams from three-point range in this postseason, just over 30%? What are they doing taking 48 threes in this game, taking over half their shots from three-point range when your best player is out? It just – I don't know if it was the game plan, or that's just the way Boston's defense begged them to do it, and they took it. But I mean, a miserable night for them, 31% from three on 48 threes. You're not gonna win games like that. You're not gonna beat the Celtics shooting like that.
No, not at all. And if you look at those shooting percentages, the Boston Celtics took care of business, beating the Cavs in every shooting percentage there is. Field goals, three pointers, free throws. The free throw differential was the one that stood out to me. And of course, a lot of that comes back to how many three-pointers the Cavs took in this game. And that starts with Caris LeVert, who obviously was trying to pick up the scoring load in Donovan Mitchell's absence. But he just went 1 of 8 from behind the arc here tonight. I think personally, you got to give a lot of credit to the perimeter defense of the Celtics. Now, we understand that, of course, Kristaps Porzingis is out at this time. So they are playing a little bit smaller. And the nice thing with Jason Tatum, obviously, back-to-back 30-point games, but, you know, he led the game tonight with 11 rebounds. He's playing bigger. He has the capability of, you know, playing a small ball four. And I think that really has been something that Cleveland has really had difficulties breaking into as far as getting paint touches. And we saw that here tonight. And when you shoot a lot of threes, you're also not going to shoot a lot of free throws. I mean, the Boston Celtics took care of their business at the foul line here tonight, going 21 of 24 from the charity stripe, while the Cleveland Cavaliers just shot 7 total free throws, making 5 of them. So pretty amazing, kind of just looking at the overall percentages with the final box score, that this was a 7-point game at the very end here between these two teams. But, you know, things are looking very, very glim for Cleveland moving forward here. I would fully expect Boston to put them out of their misery in game 5, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, you're coming back to Boston, and you know, we've seen this from the Celtics. They had a stubbed their toe in the first round against Miami, and they came back strong right after that. You know, Cleveland's going to be really kicking themselves over this game, because they really, like I mentioned at the top, they really did a good job defensively. I mean, they forced, 15 turnovers, got 26 points off turnovers in game 4. That's, you know, obviously the most they've had in a game in this postseason. They only had 25 points off turnovers total in the first 3 games. So they really stepped it up and forced Boston to a lot of mistakes, and they just, and obviously capitalized on it, but they just couldn't do enough. It's really, really hard to beat Boston if you're not on your game offensively. It just is. It's just, Boston has too good of a defense. They obviously have too good of an offense, as I mentioned at the top. And so on a night when you really do the job defensively, for the most part, especially after the first quarter, like I said, they gave up 37 in the first. That's not going to cut it in the against the Celtics, you know, trying to stop them. But if your offense can't do better than this, and I understand the situation, we all do, no Donovan Mitchell, who's been on a tear lately, and no Jared Allen, who's a big part of their team. Yeah, it's tough, but that's they're going to be kicking themselves over the fact that we played about as good as we can play on the defensive end. We just couldn't beat them. Yeah, I'd be surprised if this series goes beyond Wednesday.
Yeah, I would be right there with you. And it's going to be interesting for Boston because, of course, as we'll get to here soon, talking about the other series going on in the NBA playoffs and round number 2, they sure seem like they're going to get some rest in between series. So that could bode well for them. There's some video that was surfaced on X today. Kristaps Porzingis has started to ramp up his activity on the court. And some of the Celtics players were even joking that, you know, while Kristaps goes through his workouts, they're being sure they play Kristaps music, hoping that helps him heal a little bit faster. Not sure if you caught that, but
I did.
Do you think, do you figured you might, but as far as Kristaps Porzingis is concerned, do you think there's any hope that he could be available for the next round, or are you doubting the potential that, as far as a game 1 in the conference finals, he'd be available?
As you explained it last week or whatever, this is a similar injury to Giannis has.
Yep.
And we never saw Giannis in the first round. And who knows how much, you know, if that series had gone on, his availability, you know, throughout. So we don't know. But it's not a good injury. It's not a season-ending injury, but it just takes time. And the Celtics have that. They have a interesting decision, or almost a dilemma. You want him to rest, you want him to be healthy, but how long do you wait until and give him time to get back into, not game shape at this stage, but in the flow of a game? You don't want to wait, you know, let's assume for the sake of this argument that they make the NBA finals. Are you really going to wait until the finals to get him on the court? But then you don't want to risk anything. He's a big part of the reason why you're the favorites for, you know, coming out of the East. So it's a real tough spot for Boston. But as you mentioned, they do have the luxury of getting some rest and playing whoever comes out of the other series that we're going to get to. They're looking like they're going to be a little bit banged up, you know, to say the least, whoever comes out of this. So they have that luxury a little bit of taking their time. It's just a matter of how much time. And again, it's how healthy is Porzingis really going to be at the end of the day.
Yeah, no, it's going to be interesting to keep an eye out on that, but I think it would suit him well to go ahead and, you know, put away the Cavs in game five back home in Boston and have some time to reevaluate things there. So moving right along in a seamless transition here, let me start off with a quote from Pat Riley, because it definitely hones true to this next series. And he once famously said, "A series doesn't start until the road team wins." And in that Knicks-Pacers series, we are all squared at two games apiece, and we've yet to see a road team win. So you being our Knicks fan here on the show, how are you feeling about game five after going winless in Indiana?
Well, the game four was a miserable experience. From a Knicks standpoint, it was a miserable experience. It was a tough spot for them, playing an afternoon game two nights after you played a really hard-fought game three in Indiana, which the Knicks had every opportunity to pull that game out. And then to come back and play middle of the afternoon, not get that, even a few hours rest for this lineup. I'm sure every extra hour is they're probably grateful for that. I expect them to come out fired up, get rested. There's no excuses at this point. We all know their situation. They're banged up. They're very depleted in the roster. I mean, they're seven deep. If they can go eight, it's you feel like you won the lottery at this point, from a Knicks perspective. And game four, their energy, you saw that coming. You were waiting for that game to happen. When are they going to look worn down? When are they going to get beat up or look like they're beat up? And to the Pacers' credit, they're doing exactly what they need to do. Put the pressure on them on offense. Push it up the court. In the first two games in Madison Square Garden, they're really applying the pressure on the defensive end. If you remember, picking up full court, trying to trap in the backcourt, all good things. But I think the strategy that they employed in Indiana to really push the ball up the court, and it really worked out in game four, is really was the big key for them in that game.
Yeah, no question about that. And I'm certainly curious to see the Knicks respond at home, kind of the urgency they come out with, having lost the last two games in this series in Indiana. Of course, injuries have not helped them. That's one of my big concerns too. Not only the fact that the Indiana Pacers were able to gain some confidence and some momentum heading into such a hostile environment, which the Garden will be for them in game five. But, as far as those injuries are concerned, World B, they're starting to stack up. Do you have any huge worries that they might not be able to survive this series? Would it shock you if Indiana just kept riding this momentum and went on to win the series after the Knicks were up 2-0?
No, it wouldn't shock me at all. At some point, they've got to break down, you figure. They've got to wear out. They've got to tire out. Now, you're right. It's just too many minutes thrown their way. You know, Josh Hart is literally running a marathon up and down the court, in this series. It's been really incredible. And again, to their credit, no excuses. They're trying to play through it. They're doing the best they can. They clearly, it wasn't just Jalen Brunson whose shots were short in this game. Dante DiVincenzo's shots were hit front rim. Josh Hart was front rim. Precious Achiuwa was front rim. All those guys were shooting. They were tired. There's no other way to look at it. And there is reason. Yeah, there's plenty of reason to feel like this is, they hit the wall or it's going to be downhill. I personally think they're going to come out fired up in this game. I think the home crowd, we saw it in the first two games, is wild there, just like it was in Indiana for the weekend series. I think the crowd's going to be a lift for them. I think they're going to come out more fired up and they're going to put the pressure on. And I think they're going to go, let's go as all out, hard as we can play for as long as we can play. And then we'll just take it from there. They've obviously got to make some adjustments on defense because they just gave up way too many open threes to Indiana. And, you know, their offenses, I mentioned Boston's offense was the most efficient in the history of this league this season. Number two on the all-time list was this year's Pacers offense. So in terms of efficiency, so they can put it and score in bunches. I expect a better effort from the Knicks. You just don't know if it's going to be enough.
Yep, no question. And, of course, we did see a lot of garbage time in that game four on Sunday afternoon. However, with that said, I mean, the Knicks did get some good minutes from both your guy, Miles McBride, and also we finally saw Alec Burks come in off the bench. Do you think they did anything in that game to convince Tom Thibodeau to give him a little bit extra run in tighter ball games to give some guys a breather?
Well, he threw Alec Burks had a huge effort in game three. If you recall, he was the reason that game was so close. He was on fire in that game, and that got him more minutes for game four. That plus a blowout put him on the court even more. You know, they want to give him more minutes, and they probably will have to in game five, and feeling like, you know, there's just nobody left. The thing that's driving me crazy throughout this series is the heat that's coming down on Thibodeau, who, because everybody goes back to the Chicago days. He runs everybody into the ground, and this is his MO. And that's not the case in this spot. He has no choice. What is he going to do? He can't. There's nobody in the roster. He's got guys who are on 10-day contracts playing in the playoff games. It's an incredible situation right now. This is not how Thibodeau and his history of running people out there and just logging minutes on minutes. He doesn't have a choice right now if they're trying to win a series. It's an incredible situation. It's an unfortunate situation for the Knicks, because just like with everybody, I don't want to see Tyrese Halliburton for the Pacers with a bad back limping around. I want the Knicks at full strength to see, hey, can they get through this playoff series? Can they get through and face a Boston team at full strength? That's obviously not going to happen, but I think that Tom Thibodeau said the other day, or said after game four, this is a good example of where they are. He sat everybody at about third quarter on. He said, you know, Hart finally got some rest, Brunson got some rest, all the guys. He said he would have liked to have put Miles McBride on the bench and gotten him some rest, but he didn't have any. There's nobody else to play. Somebody's got to be on the court, and there's just nobody else there. So he had to play Miles McBride because he had no other choice. They're that depleted right now on the roster that even a key, they're probably their key reserve, has to play in the garbage time.
Yeah, and as we saw on X too, there was a viral video going out about Jalen Brunson and Tyrese Halliburton exchanging some words, and you know, Jalen made sure to remind him that it's going to be a long series. And I definitely would agree with that statement. I think this one certainly would go seven, and keeping game seven in mind, that would be, of course, in New York. So you're going to hate this question, but I got to ask it. Since we retreated to Tyrese Halliburton breaking out the classic Dame time in the play-in tournament against the Bucks when they defeated them in the semis to make it to the finals where they faced the Lakers. If Indy were to win the series at the Garden in game seven, does Tyrese Halliburton also break out the Reggie Miller choke gesture to the Knicks? Do you think he has that in him?
Well, he's definitely has gotten full of himself, and
he sure is,
blowing teams out by 30 plus points will tend to do that to you. And I saw he was mocking DiVincenzo after one of his baskets and shaking his head and pointing at him as if to say he can't guard me or whatever he was trying to do. I never got into the whole Reggie Miller garbage with Spike Lee back then and the whole choking thing. But my personal opinion, I think Reggie made all that garbage up and got himself going. I think and eventually got Spike into it. I don't think Spike did anything and got Reggie going. I've always believed that. I think Reggie got going and took it to point to Spike and wanted Spike to get involved. I think that was all a made-up thing by Reggie. So that stuff never bothered me. What bothers me is the fact that he scored 25 points in the fourth quarter, that Spike Lee game. It bothers me that he scored 8 points in 9 seconds in game one the following series. I don't care about all the other stuff. I don't care what he says. So I'm not going to care if Tyrese Halliburton pulls a stupid gesture like that, because it's going to mean that what bothers me is as a Knicks fan, is that that means they will have won the game or in game seven or game five. At the end of the day, you said it. I didn't like what I saw on Sunday from a fan's perspective or whatever, because the game was out of hand, was embarrassing. But the Pacers got to figure out a way to win two in the Garden, and I don't see it happening. I just don't see it happening.
That's definitely a tall task, and I think I'm right there with you. I would be shocked if the Indiana Pacers are able to win two of the next three in Manhattan.
At the end of the day, they're a bottom 10 defense, and that's what I'll hang my head on the fact that their defense is going to have to hold up for another three games or two games, whatever it may be. I don't see it.
Yeah, and you already pointed out, I mean, it was more fatigue in what we both watched, our eye test of the game on why the Knicks were missing shots. We never gave credit to the Pacers' defense for being exceptional. It was more
And by the way, I'm not trying to, you know, I'm being a Knicks fan, I'm a Knicks homer or whatever. The Pacers' offense was on fire in that game four. They get full credit for that. Almost 59% from the field, 14-3. They were on fire for that. So they get credit for their offensive explosion. I want to see them do it on the defensive end, two games in the Garden.
Yeah, no question. So moving right along here, let's get to another interesting series between the Denver Nuggets and the Minnesota Timberwolves. This one is squared up at 2-2 in the series, but not how you would think the series would be 2-2, of course, with Denver dropping both games at home and then ending up winning both games on the road. So things have definitely changed as far as the temperature of the Minnesota Timberwolves. I mean, everyone was almost writing them off as the big winners. They're gonna, you know, beat the defending champions, and they're on their way to making it to the conference finals. And Jamal Murray seems to have gotten his act together. He's feeling a little bit more healthy, and of course, the Joker has stepped it up offensively, getting a little bit more aggressive on his touches. So, you know, what's your thoughts on all of this? I mean, this is one of the rare instances where, you know, a team drops both games at home and then finds a way to win two games on the road after looking terrible at home in a place that we've always said they have a big, you know, home advantage with the altitude, the crowd, things of that nature. And to get everything back in gear on the road, winning both in Minnesota against a team that was the hottest team in the NBA, swept the Suns, won the first two games of this series. I mean, how shocked are you just with the Nuggets turning things around all of a sudden?
I'll be honest with you. I wasn't that shocked. It wasn't a shocker to me because the team that I saw at home at Denver offensively, you know, from this being the Nuggets, that's not the team I had watched for about two or three months when they were basically the best team in the league. That, you know, and even in the first round, even against the Lakers, the thing that had bothered me was about Denver, and I mentioned to you last week, they hadn't really played well offensively, even in the Lakers series. It wasn't great. They had spurts where they made the comebacks. You know, they were down 20 and at home against the Lakers in game two, I believe, and came back and won that one at the buzzer on Murray's jumper. So I wasn't shocked that they were able to come back. What shocked me was their play up to this point has been very un-Denver-like, you know, in the postseason. That's just how it was. So there was reason if you're a Minnesota fan or you're not a Denver fan, there was reason to feel really comfortable or really good about yourselves. But Denver found its offense in Minnesota, back-to-back games with at least 125 points per 100 possessions is really getting the job done efficiency-wise. And you mentioned Joker. Joker in game four, 26 field goal attempts. The most he's had in the playoffs. He only done that about four or five times in the regular season. That's a very uncharacteristic thing for him to take that many shots. We don't see that from him. His impact is much more efficient. I get the job done. You know, I can deal with 20 shots or 18 shots or whatever and get my 30 or 35 or whatever. But, you know, he absolutely, you're right. He was the aggressor on offense, certainly in game four. And, you know, he's still not shooting the ball from the perimeter very well. I think he was only 1-for-5 in that game four. And he hadn't shot well in the postseason, or really. Let's be honest, he hasn't shot well from the perimeter the whole season. his best, biggest impact has been inside the three-point line. But he still is he's a difficult matchup night in, night out, even for the defensive player of the year, like Rudy Gobert.
Yeah, so I guess the million-dollar question for you will be, do you see this series going seven?
I can see it going seven, absolutely. I think as bad as Minnesota played, as good as they were playing up until they got those home games against Denver, they played just as poorly. But I think they can get that back. I think they have a player like Anthony Edwards, who's maybe the best player in the postseason so far. Probably is the best player in the postseason so far. If I'm Minnesota, I'm liking my chances to at least get one more in Denver. I've done it already. And like I mentioned, Denver has not been great offensively. And so I have this great defense. If I keep giving up 100, if I'm Minnesota and I keep giving up 125 points per 100%, my defensive efficiency is that high. Yeah, the series is over. There's no way they can't do that. Why I would feel good if I was a Minnesota fan is that's very uncharacteristic of them. That's not their defense. That's not the way we see it. We've seen it all year. I've mentioned over and over how they've been the best defense in the league during the season by far. It's there's a wide gap between them and I believe the Celtics at number two. So if I'm Minnesota, I got to step up my defense. I got to do some things differently, but I've proven I can do that.
Yep, no question. And looking forward to this one tomorrow night, Tuesday, as the Denver Nuggets will host the Minnesota Timberwolves. We will be broadcasting this one live on 48 Minutes Live on playback.tv. So definitely check that out. Come hang out with us, engage, have some fun. We've been having some good crowds. So the more the merrier. Hopefully you can join us, and we're looking forward to seeing if the Denver Nuggets can rattle off three straight wins against this tough Minnesota team. Now, as for a game four that's currently underway, it's halftime in the series between the Oklahoma City Thunder and the Dallas Mavericks. Mavericks up at half, 54-43 at time of taping. Mavericks have a 2-1 lead. This was an Oklahoma City team that, of course, swept the Pelicans, won game one of this series, but now find themselves down 2-1 and find themselves down at half here at game four. Do you point more credit to Dallas right now and potentially that defense? Or do you see the Thunder kind of getting their act together and still having some life in this series?
It's going to be tough for Oklahoma City. I mentioned to you before we went on this statement, I'm one of those people that doesn't subscribe to the theory that I'm going to dismiss Oklahoma City immediately just because they're too young. They haven't been through the fire of the postseason yet. I didn't buy that before the playoffs start. I don't necessarily think that is the case right now. They're not playing well and right now. And I think that is a credit to Dallas' defense, because from about the second half of the season on, from about maybe All-Star break on, they were one of the top defenses in the league, which is really what was all that was left from this team to really be successful, was to step up their defense. And the minute they did, their world got a whole lot better. And they came up big at home in game three against the Thunder. They're holding them to, just over 100 points and just over 100 points per 100 possessions. So, it was one of their best defensive efforts, certainly the best defensive effort of the series. And it's looking like a halftime of game four, unless things change dramatically for Oklahoma City, they're on their way, for the Mavericks are, to another convincing game defensively. And that's a key. They have, we've seen them play on the playback TV on 48 Minutes Live. They have athletes. They can get after it. It's not, Luka is a, he's borderline defensive liability. We'll just call it like it is. It's just how it is. He is. It's, we can sugarcoat it any way we want, but we've seen him play, and he doesn't exactly put max effort into his defense. That's totally fine. He gets it done on the offensive end. That's Jason Kidd's problem, not mine. But Derek Jones is a ridiculous athlete. PJ Washington, Gafford, Lively, Kyrie Irving can play defense. There's a lot of defenders on this team, and they get it going here. they're a tough matchup for anybody, including, you know, Oklahoma City, including anybody in the East. They have the defensive athletes on this team, and they showed it, like I mentioned, after the All-Star break to get it done at that end. Their offense is not going to be an issue, obviously, Kyrie, or shouldn't be, with Kyrie and Luka running the show there. And it's just a matter of getting it done defensively. They did it in game three. They're doing it so far in game four. Good things are looking good for the Mavericks at this point.
Yeah, I think a lot of credit has to go to that Mavericks defense. However, I do got to ask you, World B, because it is certainly legitimate to ask this. Are we on the brink of remembering this as the PJ Washington series? He scored the third most points in this series so far, and I bet you didn't have that on your bingo card.
No, I did not. I will say this, having watched him for years in Charlotte, you know, yes, I'm the guy that watched the Hornets. That's me. You know, good. If you're looking for the fan. Like yeah, if you're looking for the Hornets fan, singular, that would be me. But having watched him for years there, he has that capability. He had that potential. And they often in Charlotte put him in the middle to draw big guys out and run that offense, especially when they had when James Borrego used to be their coach, they would run that type of offense. So he's had that kind of potential. He hasn't shown it for this long of a stretch, and certainly not in a postseason setting like this. So it is a surprise. It would not have been on my bingo card, but it is not the shocker of all shockers, given he has this potential in him. And, you know, you got to stop they need another a third guy there if you're going to try and keep Luka and Kyrie in check. And PJ's getting it done for real.
Yeah, it's been a little bit of a shock to me. I thought coming into this series, the kind of the third wheel for the Dallas Mavericks possibly could have been Daniel Gafford, as he played pretty strong basketball against the LA Clippers in round one. I thought he would definitely have the physicality and size to, you know, get some easy buckets, but also make it tough on Chet Holmgren, which he is doing defensively. Chet struggled in this series, but offensively, you know, I thought he was going to be spoon-fed for some easy buckets and kind of be the difference maker scoring-wise. But boy, was I wrong. PJ Washington has certainly stepped up his game. Well,
by the way, the most shots of anybody in that game tied with SGA in game three there. So talk about things you didn't have on your bingo card. That was one of them as well, that he would have that many shots.
Yep. And as we go ahead and get into our second half here, World B, let's talk about some of the coaching carousel, as we've had some news break within the past week around the association. And let's start off in Phoenix, as Frank Vogel was dismissed of his head coaching duties. And very quickly, the Suns went on to hire Mike Budenholzer to go ahead and take the reins of this ball club, hopefully take advantage of the short window of time this team really kind of has to compete for a championship. I thought it was the right hire. I think with the names available out there and the resumes each candidate brings, he probably was the best fit for the job. And he's also an Arizona native, so there's a good storyline there. But what was your overall thoughts on the dismissal of Frank Vogel and then the hiring of Coach Bud?
The dismissal of Frank Vogel, I didn't really make a lot of sense to me. Mm-hmm. I don't think he was the problem there. I'm a Frank Vogel guy. I mean, I think he's done a good job at other stops. He, you know, here in Orlando, it wasn't that successful, but he didn't have a whole lot of talent either to work with. But he's a good coach, and I, you know, they want to pay him the rest of his contract and for 1 year. It's not unprecedented to do that. See Larry Brown with the New York Knicks back, you know, about 10 years ago as evidence of such a silly thing. But that was also another franchise in disarray, much as I think Phoenix is at the moment. That being said, I'd like to hire, too, Coach Bud. I think he's a quality coach. I've liked him for a long time, going back to the Hawks days. Certainly his work with the Bucks, it speaks for itself. Got a title, and yep, they were one of the premier teams on the defensive end and one of the premier teams on the offensive end for years. So Now, this is a good move for them. The funny thing I got, I saw the release that the Suns had and the owner talking about, you know, how much they love, you know, this is such a great hire, how successful Coach Bud is and how, you know, good it is to have him on board. And, well, if you liked him so much, why didn't you hire him the previous year after the Bucks fired him? He had before, you know, he was available before you fired Monty Williams. When did he become so great in, you know, in a year span of not coaching? So that I found that kind of funny. You loved him so much. Well, why did it take you a year and a waste of Kevin Durant's, you know, season to go ahead and do this? But that being said, I think he's a good coach. He proved to be a successful coach. He had the Hawks win 60 games one season and got them to the conference finals against the Cavaliers with LeBron when LeBron and those guys swept them. But when he had players in Atlanta, he had one of the best defenses in the league. When he had players in Milwaukee, he had one of the best defenses in the league. So he's got players here, but they're not that great defensively. But he also knows how to deal with veterans, as you mentioned. And, you know, he's pretty innovative with his offensive philosophy. You know, the five-out spacing that he did, especially when Giannis was there. You know, a lot of teams copy that now. And that was Coach Bud doing that and being successful with it in Milwaukee. So he's got the players to pull that off in Phoenix. So let's see how it works out. I think they'll be a better team next season, whether they can compete for a championship, that's up for debate. But I think they're stuck with that roster, and they got a coach in there that can maybe make them a little bit better.
Yeah, and you mentioned the fact that they don't have a lot of defensive players in Phoenix, but certainly I know one thing with Coach Bud is he's going to hold those guys accountable. And even if they feel like maybe even – going against the grain and not caring about the accountability. At this point, the pressure is on the players because they've now had two great coaches. I'm going to leave Monty out of this because he only got like a little bit of, Devin Booker, and this wasn't the same group. But Brad Beal, Kevin Durant specifically, I mean, you had Frank Vogel. That didn't work. If it doesn't work with Coach Budenholzer, I mean, that's on you guys. I mean, this is no longer a coaching problem. It's a you problem. So I'm really curious to see how those two respond. I think Coach Bud, with his experience with veteran star players, is going to be a big benefit to this team. And, I think there is some hope on the horizon for Suns fans now.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think this whole season that happened, was this a Vogel issue that they didn't succeed, or was this just a player issue, the roster issue, I should say, because everything that I saw and everything that I heard, this isn't on Frank Vogel. And I don't know how good or poor a job he did at coaching wise. This is a roster makeup issue that they were, was a big problem. They went and got Bradley Beal, which hasn't fit in, and who knows if it ever will. This isn't on, I agree with you. This isn't on, it's already on the players. It's not next season on the players. I think this past season's on the players. This offseason is on them. And going forward, you're right. This is on the players.
Yeah, I mean, they just got a free pass this year because they used their get out of jail free card with we can just blame the coach on this one. You know, KD coming out and saying, I wasn't used effectively this year. Well, that's kind of out the door now. You've already used your pass. It's gone. You don't have another pass. It's now on you. So, unfortunately, I think it was a roster issue. I 100% agree. I've been preaching all year they needed a point guard and never got a point guard, not even at the deadline, even like an Ish Smith type guy. They didn't get a point guard at all. So roster makeup certainly was the issue. But with star players, as they typically can do, you know, they can scapegoat the coach, and they just did that. But now you don't have that pass anymore. This is it. So it's either put up or shut up. Now, moving right along here, let's get to your squad, the Charlotte Hornets. You already singled yourself out as the only fan. obviously, one of the exciting news for the Hornets is they've got a new coach, and it's a first year head coach. Rookie coach Charles Lee is going to get his first opportunity. He's been a guy that's definitely interviewed for jobs around the league the last couple of years, was on Coach Budenholzer's staff in Milwaukee, and obviously is right now currently a member of the successful Boston Celtics coaching staff. So how are you feeling about getting a younger guy to lead this group that's obviously got some really impressive previous stops?
Yeah, I think this is a terrific hire by the Charlotte Hornets. I think if you're looking for the top young assistant out there, from everything you read and everything you've seen, I don't know if there's a better young assistant than Charles Lee. I mean, as you mentioned, he was on a staff in Milwaukee that won an NBA title. He's on a staff as a lead assistant for Joe Mazzulla, who had the most dominant team in the league this season. So you've got a guy who clearly has learned from some of the best, and now he gets to take that. He, like you said, he's wanted an opportunity, or tried for an opportunity for years, and now he gets a team that, you know, has been a mess. It's just been an embarrassment in this league for the last almost 10 years now. No playoff appearances since 2016. One winning season since that time. They've gone through Steve Clifford twice now, and James Borrego, who I think is a good guy, and I think he's a good coach, but just couldn't get it done there. The Hornets, believe it or not, can turn things around somewhat fairly quickly with the roster that they have. It's not a great roster, but it is a roster that can get them a lot more wins than 21 that they had this season. LaMelo Ball was hurt for most of the season. Another guy in the middle, a young guy, 22-year-old Mark Williams, center out of Duke, who was promising as a rookie. He missed most of the season with a back issue. So assuming he gets healthy, he was a big guy in the middle. He was another starter. You already have Brandon Miller, who's one of the top rookies in the league, looked like he's a keeper. So now you pair Melo and Brandon Miller together. They got to make a decision on Miles Bridges. I don't know what they're going to do with that. It's going to be interesting. But they had the potential to get better quickly, especially with a guy like Charles Lee, who's going to bring some philosophy there, you know, take what he's learned at other stops and along with his own philosophy and make a difference. I think he's going to be a difference maker on this team, and I think it will be somewhat quick.
Yeah, no, best of luck to Coach Lee. Always excited to see younger guys finally get an opportunity. This seems to be a great opportunity for him to really showcase his abilities and get things going with Charlotte, where there's going to be some leniency. This is the perfect type of job that Adrian Griffin probably should have gotten, not a finals expectation. So I'm glad he got a realistic job where it's like, hey, well, let you kind of ease into things, grow as a leader along with this group and really kind of, you know, formulate this core.
And one more thing too, this is no longer, you know, people, I realize, I know the stigma's still there. This is not Michael Jordan's Hornets anymore. New ownership, they've come in. New president of basketball operations. This is his first big hire bringing in. So it's, you know, they're totally trying to redo the whole franchise makeup, the atmosphere, everything. Just, you know, for lack of a better phrase, get away from that period of Hornets basketball and try and, you know, put your own stamp on it. And you have to feel like, if you're a fan of the Hornets, of which I am, that you've got things going in the right direction. It may take time. I don't think it's going to take as much time as maybe others do, but they still have a lot of things they have to shore up. But this is an excellent first start for them.
Yep, no doubt about that. Now, moving on to the Western Conference, a team in a totally different situation here is the Los Angeles Lakers, as they, of course, also have a head coaching vacancy, as they dismissed their head coach, Darvin Ham, shortly after being eliminated from the playoffs. And I just want to open this up. Do you have any ideas on who you think would be best for this group? As we know, and we've known throughout the years, LeBron James does a lot of the leading, a lot of this decision-making, has a huge voice with the matters of not just roster makeup, but also like in-game decisions. I mean, Woj has reported that J.J. Redick and James Borrego are the two names to continue to monitor. But what are your thoughts on this vacancy? Because it's a very complicated one.
It's absolutely, because on top of everything else, trying to find a coach, you don't know what LeBron's future is with the Lakers. It yep. sounds as if he'll be back, but you don't know. And it, as long as there's an unknown there, you need some sort of commitment from him to go for that's first and foremost. Maybe, I mean, for crying out loud, if he dictates that much, let him run the show. Let him be the coach. Right. I mean, if that's how it's going to be. Of those two players, two people you mentioned, J.J. Redick and James Borrego, well, one's never been a coach. And one,
At all.
And one didn't really get the job done the way Hornets fans would have hoped in Charlotte. I don't think he had a great hand dealt to him. He had moments where the team was good, just not enough of them. And the best season they've actually had, Charlotte, under Borrego, they got rid of him after that season. So, you know, the only winning season they've had in the last 8 years, and they got rid of their coach after that. So, I think Borrego do a good job wherever he goes. I would not want to deal with that mess, though. I don't want – if I'm just – you better pay me. You just better yeah. pay me if you're going to bring me in and do that. So, I think he's a really good guy by all accounts. I think he was well-liked in Charlotte. It just wasn't getting the job. A guy I would personally put as a candidate would be, I don't know if he'd want this job either, but Kenny Atkinson, with the assistant with the Golden State Warriors. He's been with Steve Kerr's staff for a few years now. And, you know, he was supposed to have the Hornets job a couple years ago, and he backed out after accepting the job and threw that whole thing in disarray. But he did a good job in Brooklyn about 10 years ago. He was only stopped there. He got the job and got let go or whatever right before the COVID season. So he didn't have the luxury of having a lot of players there. But I thought he did a good job there and worthy of another chance, another opportunity. Now you give him some players. If LeBron comes back, if Anthony Davis is healthy, that roster is going to change somehow. I don't know how yet. So I would like to see – he'd be my choice.
Yeah, I would go with a coach with experience. I don't think you can play around with this. And even someone who happens to care about J.J. Redick, I don't want to see him be the next Steve Nash. Never really had a coaching job before. At least Nash was a consultant. I don't even think J.J. has done that. But I get the podcast that J.J. does with LeBron and the link there of mutual respect and stuff. But I really don't want to see J.J. Redick be thrown into that kind of fire if he's going to dip his toes in the head coaching landscape of the league, because we saw how that ended up for Steve Nash. And even as a Nash fan, I think that was an unfair position. And I think Redick would be wise to just stay on the mic until he gets the right opportunity, or at the very least knows what LeBron's going to do.
Here's my scenario. How about this dream scenario, Russ? Let's play this. Because right. we like Tim Legler so much, and we yep. enjoyed his time on 48 Minutes, and we think he did a great job. He just did his first game of the season, I believe, over the weekend as a color analyst for ESPN, and hit a home run by all accounts. Now, here's our plan. J.J. Redick goes and takes that job, leaving a hole with ESPN's broadcast, and they finally do the right thing, the smart thing, and bring in J.J. Redick and possibly Monica, our other friend, Monica McNutt, yeah. To work a three-man team with Mike Breen. That would immediately make the ESPN-ABC broadcast trio broadcast lineup a whole lot better, and we would certainly like it because we could promote our 48 minutes even more than with those two alums.
Yeah, Legler definitely belongs in the finals broadcast for sure, and would love to see Monica work in that game as well. So fingers Absolutely. Crossed for that if J.J. gets the job. Good point there. Now, last order of business here tonight will be we did have the NBA draft lottery on Sunday afternoon, and the Atlanta Hawks, of all teams, walked away as the big winners, securing the number one overall pick, despite only having a 3% chance to do so. On the flip side, the Detroit Pistons, of course, had the worst record in the league this season. And for the third consecutive season in a row, they'll have the fifth pick. So do you think Adam Silver is pretty much already tried to, you know, done a great job of making sure teams don't tank? Because right now, I don't think they're really getting the rewards from it.
I think they're doing it. I think he's, of all the criticisms you can throw his way, and it seems to come up a lot during the postseason, this is one of them where I think he's done a good job. You gotta deter teams from, you know, going that route as best you can. And I don't think there's a fireproof way to do it, but this is as close as you can do it. And yeah, I think we saw some teams really go in recent years before this, just go in the tank and just throw players out there that didn't belong in the NBA. At least this season, you had a lot of young rosters. If you're going to do this, the Pistons go with a young roster. They just threw everybody out there. Let's see what happens. The Blazers tried to do that before injuries caught up with them. San Antonio is trying to do that with their roster. The Hornets are trying to do that to some extent, but they got hurt as well. So they, at least if you're going to suffer these losses, you do it with the young guys and you try to get better instead of throwing a bunch of aging veterans out there and just, you know, making it look embarrassing. You know, Oklahoma City, it worked out eventually for them. They had a lineup a few years ago that was the starting lineup. Some games, the oldest guy was 21. Yep. I mean, that's not something I want to see as a rule either. But you're not, at least you're trying to build something there. You're trying to, you know, grow something. The Pistons are trying to build their young guys. They're not just trying to work out for a great draft pick. And by the way, who in the world was trying to go in the tank this year for draft pick? Because this is going to be one of the worst drafts we've seen in years. Who was trying to tank in order to get the number one pick for this year draft?
Yeah, from all early reports, it sounds like to kind of keep things into perspective for this year's draft, the number one pick in this year's draft is like a typical analytically based on the college numbers or prospect numbers, however they put it.
Now let's see. I mean, let's see how next year works. Yeah.
Slash the top five picks out of this year's draft, and the number one pick this year is typically like the sixth pick in most drafts.
And next year, let's see next season these teams what they're going to do, because there is a clear number one pick out there in Cooper Flagg, high school kid who's going to Duke. He would be number one this year if he was allowed to be it. So let's see what these teams do trying to secure that next season. But you're right, the odds are stacked in a way that it doesn't benefit you to do that.
Yep. And with Atlanta winning, we definitely have to mention this. With Atlanta winning the number one overall pick, this is certainly could open up a potential avenue to also help trade Trae Young or DeJounte Murray. Of course, that franchise really has to make a decision. I think there's no question you can't have both of them anymore. You got to try something new. And, you know, having Trae Young's large contract and a number one pick could maybe potentially, you know, help garnish a better trade return, wouldn't you say?
It absolutely could. It also, they could take the kid that you mentioned, the French kid for at number one, which would mean
ESR.
And which would mean potentially moving on from Clint Capella, who's another tradable asset, if they decide to go that route. I'd be stunned if the opening night roster next season included both Trae Young and Murray. We'll see. It doesn't seem like a fit that works. And I don't know where this franchise necessarily goes in the immediate. They made the play-in tournaments. They get credit for that. But, yeah, they really got to make a decision there and have a plan going forward. And having a number one pick certainly helps.
Definitely does. Pretty amazing. Going from the play-in tournament to the number one pick in this year's draft. But with that, that will do it for this edition of the 48 Minutes Podcast on Believe, presented by BetOnline. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll be back with you next week to be sure you're up to date in 48 on all things around the association. Take care, everybody.